Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 850. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about monuments and museums, neighborhoods and history, pandas and presidents, as we go to the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Chris Christensen from Amateur Traveler. Let's talk about D.C. I'd like to welcome to the show Rob from TripHacksDC.com, who's come to talk to us about Washington, D.C. Rob, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I wanted to do a show on Washington, D.C. because it's a destination we've talked about before, but there's so much to do in the Washington, D.C. area, not just in D.C., but in the region. And I listened to Rob's podcast about it. He was the person I thought of in terms of coming on the show and talking about it. Rob, what's your connection with Washington? How long have you lived in the area?
So my connection is that I am a Washington, D.C. tour guide. I own my own tour company, TripHex D.C. Tours, and as you said, have the podcast. And my goal is to help everyone to have the best possible trip when they come. An exciting destination. There's a lot to do here. And it, just like many destinations, can feel overwhelming. So I've been a tour guide for a little over a decade now. I've been doing TripHex D.C. for half a decade. And so I just really want to help people have a great time when they come.
Excellent. And why should someone come to Washington, D.C.? And let's do this in two part. I don't normally do this. If you're from the U.S., why should you go? And then if you're not?
I think the answer to the question applies to both groups. And it's the question I would ask when you're visiting any destination, which is, what can I see and do here that I can't anywhere else in the world? And by nature of the federal government being in Washington, D.C., we have a whole bunch of federal government sites. And so there are lots of things that are completely unique to Washington, D.C. that don't exist anywhere else in the U.S. or in the world. But at the same time, Washington, D.C. is a big city. And we have lots of great big city amenities like award-winning restaurants and theater and sports. And so many people come to Washington, D.C. because they are a quote-unquote history buff or they really want to experience the U.S. history. And you can definitely do that here. But even if you're not really into that stuff, you can still come here and find lots of fun things to do as well. So for an international visitor, I have lots of international visitors on my tours, and many of them, they always start off by saying, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry, I don't know anything about your country, I don't know anything about U.S. history, and they frequently surprise me. People know more than they often give themselves credit for. But even if you feel like I don't know that much about the U.S. or U.S. history, Washington, D.C. is a great place to come and learn about it. And so I think it applies to both Americans who are visiting and folks from other countries as well.
Excellent. And what kind of itinerary are you going to recommend for us?
So I think you want to give yourself plenty of time when you come. One of the biggest mistakes that people make when they come here is they don't plan enough days. So for domestic visitors, for Americans, I think you need at a minimum a full weekend, 3 full days in Washington, D.C., with the caveat that you live close enough by that you might come back in the future, that you might leave on that third day with a list of things to do on your next trip, and then you can come back and you can do them again. For someone who lives farther away, maybe you live in California, you're on the other coast, and you're coming to Washington, D.C., but you're probably not going to be back for a while, or you're coming from Europe, or you're coming from far enough away that this is your one chance I think a minimum of 5 days is required, and probably 7 is a really solid number. 7 days to be here is a good number, whether you're American or international. But definitely don't cut your time short. Give yourself plenty of time to come, and I think that you'll be able to build a really good itinerary from there.
Excellent. Where are we to start?
So the way I approach this is that I think you want to do a mix of federal government stuff and non-federal government stuff. So I explained earlier that Washington, D.C. is unique because we have the federal government here and we have lots of unique sites. So that includes things like the Capitol, the Library of Congress, the National Archives, the White House, the Lincoln Memorial. These are sites that exist in Washington, D.C. and don't exist anywhere else. So you're going to want to do the federal government stuff because it's unique and you're not going to do it anywhere else. At the same time, a lot of that federal government stuff is open 10 to 5. The museums, for example, right. The Smithsonian museums, they're all daytime activities. And so you're really only going to have part of your day filled up by that stuff. So that's where I think the non-federal government stuff comes in as well. And I think exploring neighborhoods, trying out different foods and cuisines, and we'll get into foods and cuisines in a bit, I think. But thinking about things that are fun, that you like to do, that are not the Wikipedia guidebook type, you must do these things because they're the federal government stuff. Okay. I think a mix of both is the key. And I also say that because another mistake that I see people make all the time is what I call museum fatigue, which is that you come to Washington, D.C., and you get the list. There's 20 museums on the list, and they're part of the Smithsonian. They're part of the National Gallery of Art. You've got the U.S. Botanic Gardens. You've got private museums like the International Spy Museum. And they're all amazing. Don't get me wrong. They're all amazing, but they're huge, and they can be exhausting. And so a mistake I see is people will send me an itinerary, and it's a few days long, and every single day there's 3 museums back to back. And it's like you're just going to exhaust yourself, and at some point, it stops becoming enjoyable because you've just gotten information overload. You're on your feet all day. You're taking in all this information. So you need to build in breaks. You need to build in some activities that don't require the same amount of brain power as some of these things, and that you might be able to get off your feet for a little bit as well.
So day one, I'm going to leave my hotel. Is there a particular area you'd have me stay in, actually, before I leave my hotel? I guess we should talk about where that should be.
Yeah, let's talk about where to stay. So this is one of the hardest choices you will make. All big cities, and Washington, D.C. is included in this, have an overwhelming number of hotel options. And I speak from experience both as a tour guide and as a traveler myself. When I go to, say, New York City, which is a place I go to every year, one of the hardest things to do is just pick a hotel because there are hundreds of choices, and narrowing down the list is tricky. So I always try to be geographically focused. I try to say, okay, I'm going to focus on this specific geographic area, and that'll really narrow down the list. And then I can do a little bit of research on hotels and pick from there. So I think for first-time visitors to Washington, D.C., if you've never been here before, your best bet is to stay downtown in a hotel in the general vicinity of the White House. So most people know the White House's address is 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest, so that's roughly 16th Street. And so if you pick a hotel in one of the few blocks around 16th Street, that's a pretty good bet. And the reason why I think that's great for first-time visitors is because it's central. It's central to the National Mall, it's central to the museums, the monuments, but it's also central to Metro. So we'll talk about getting around in a bit, but you want to be close to as many lines as you can so that no matter where you're going, whether that's uptown to the National Zoo or whether that's over to Virginia for Arlington Cemetery, that you don't have to spend a lot of time in transportation or stressing about getting around. So I think downtown near the White House is great for first-time visitors.
Now if you're 3 times there for first-time visitors, because you're assuming a second-time visitor isn't going to spend as much time on the mall, or?
So I think typically, once you've been to D.C. once, you get a general sense of what you like about the city and the places that you like in the city. So, for example, a good friend of mine comes to D.C. quite frequently, and he loves staying over by DuPont Circle because he likes the neighborhood vibes, he likes the restaurants over there, he likes the fact that it feels more like a residential neighborhood and less like a downtown business district. And so he's been here many times and has discovered that's the vibe that he likes. Now, other folks, they come to D.C. and they go to a new-ish area called The Wharf, which opened about five, 6 years ago. And it's new and it's exciting and there's some brand new hotels over there. And so for repeat visitors, staying over there might be a great option because it's not in the middle of the city. It's got every area's got pros and cons. But maybe you went there for a few hours during your trip and you discover you love the area and now you want to stay there on a repeat trip. So I actually, because this is a question I get frequently, wrote a guide on where to stay. And I identified 11 areas where you can stay that I will say if you choose a hotel in one of these 11 areas, you're good to go. And the reason why I did that, rather than to just tell everyone, just stay downtown, just stay near the White House, is because, like I said, people have their own unique wants and needs and preferences. And some people don't want to stay in the city. They only want to stay in the suburbs. And so if that's you, then I have options for that. Some people want to be in more of a neighborhoody type area versus more of a downtown business district type area. So if that's you, there's options for that. Some people just say, I just want the least expensive place that's in an acceptable area. And if that's you, then you could choose from one of the 11 and you're good to go. So that's why I approach it that way. But that's why I also kept saying over for first-time visitors, because I do think if it's your first time, you want to try to be central to give yourself the best opportunity to see and do as many different things as you can.
Okay. So I'm leaving my hotel, wherever that may be. What are you going to take me first?
So I think that there's a few things that you should probably do at some point during your trip, but I don't necessarily think that they have to go in a specific order. Okay. So I think most people should go on a tour of the Capitol. I think that's definitely something that you should build into your itinerary. I think that everyone should take a guided tour of the monuments, whether that's with me or with somebody else. But the tricky thing is that when you're building an itinerary, you have to build it in a way that you do things when they're available. So, for example, the Library of Congress is not open 7 days per week. So if your first day, if day one is on a Sunday, you're not going there on your first day because they're not open on Sundays. And same thing with a tour. So not every tour runs every day of the week. And this is particularly true since COVID. A lot of tour companies have gone out of business. So you have to kind of just build your itinerary, slotting things in when they're available and when you can do them. But I think things like going on a tour of the Capitol, going on a tour of the monuments and memorials, going to some of the Smithsonian museums are definitely things that you should do. Whether you do that on day one, day three, day five, I don't think actually matters that much. I don't think that the order is all that important. Although some people would say the first day they go to a new destination, they always want to go on some sort of bus ride or bus tour as to quote unquote get your bearings. And you can certainly do that. I think it's important to understand that when you do that, you're really getting a very high level overview of the city. And you should plan to take that and then drill down as your week goes through.
Now, you talked about doing a tour of the Capitol. I know I can do a tour of the White House, but that's going to be harder to get on. Can anybody get on the Capitol tour, and how far in advance do I need to plan?
Yeah, so a Capitol tour is a little tricky because there's two options that you have for doing a Capitol tour, and it's not always entirely obvious which one you should do or which one's better or how to do it. So for a Capitol tour, you can either book a tour through the Capitol Visitor Center, and that's as simple as going on the Capitol Visitor Center website, opening up their calendar, choosing the date, choosing the time, putting in your name and phone number, and you're booked, you're ready. The second option is to book a tour through one of your Congress members' offices. So this is for Americans only, and so for international visitors, you have one option, the Capitol Visitor Center, and that's pretty straightforward. If you're an American, you have three representatives in the federal government. You have one House member, you have two senators. This, of course, assumes you're from one of the 50 states, not the territories or DC, but that's a whole other can of worms. And so you can contact one of those three people's offices, and on almost every House.gov or Senate.gov member's website, there's going to be a little page called Visit DC or Tour DC, or everybody calls it something different, but
and
look
I'm
for something along those lines.
A couple months ahead if I'm trying to go through Congress?
Yeah, at least a few weeks. And the what those tours typically are congressional office tours, typically led by one of the office's interns.
Oh, interesting.
Sometimes, if you get really lucky, you might get someone who's not an intern, but it's typically led by an intern. And so there's pros and cons to both. A Capitol Visitor Center tour is led by a professional tour guide who works strictly for the Capitol Visitor Center, and their entire job is giving tours. A congressional office tour is led by an intern who's giving tours is one of many jobs that they have, right? And so depending on who you get, might make or break whether you have a great time or an okay time. It's just total luck of the draw. So I typically advise people to, unless there's a specific reason why you really want to go with your Congress member's office, to just book through the Capitol Visitor Center, and definitely a few weeks in advance, especially during peak times of year. So that's spring break and summer break, because those do book up. If you're coming off peak, which would be winter or to a lesser extent fall, you might be able to get in on a week's notice, maybe less if you're lucky, but definitely a few weeks in advance in any case.
Okay. And the peak season for DC is typically when kids are out of school, because we get a lot of that. And it's some of the best weather in DC, like August, right?
August, not in my opinion. My personal favorite month of year is October, I think. Assuming there's not a hurricane coming up the East Coast, October has the best weather. But we're recording this in May, and this May we have had some excellent weather. So if you're just strictly focused on weather, May and October, I think, are the two best. Some people also like September. If you lean more towards liking the heat, then you might like September more than October.
One of the reasons to think about that spring break, though, if you have to take your, if you're going with your kids, because you might see much better weather. The first time I was in D.C. was the eighth day of an air stagnation alert. And you don't want that. And you can guess what month that was.
So, I'm going to guess it was either July or August.
It was August, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you also talked about a tour of the monuments. I think a lot of people know the Lincoln Memorial, the Washington Monument, which I can go up in again, as if I recall correctly, but I have to allow time for that. But what are the ones they don't know that they really would enjoy seeing?
I'll just tell you what sites are on my tour, and then we can go from there. So on a TripHex DC tour of the monuments, we see the Lincoln Memorial, Jefferson Memorial, Franklin Delano Roosevelt Memorial, Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, Korean War Memorial, Vietnam Memorial, and World War II Memorial. And we see them all in one go. So the reason why I recommend a tour of the monuments, whether that's with me or with someone else, is because when I am out seeing them, I notice there are always 1,000 people over at the Lincoln Memorial. It's the most visited site in all of Washington, D.C. Right. And then right next door is the Korean War Memorial, an amazing, wildly underappreciated memorial that has a fraction
also
of the number of people there.
Artistically stunning. I love the Korean War Memorial, and also the FDR Memorial that you mentioned, I think, is very interesting.
And those are two, the FDR Memorial and Korean War Memorial, that when you go there, you will notice there are fewer people there than at most famous ones. And I think that's a shame, because I think they're all amazing and all worth seeing. And so when you go on a tour, there's no chance you're going to miss anything. There's no chance you're going to accidentally skip the Korean War Memorial, because it's tucked off to the side, and depending on what route you take, you might accidentally miss it. So whether you DIY it, if you do DIY it, I highly recommend making a Google map for yourself or something so that you make sure you don't accidentally miss anything. But when you see them on a tour, there's no chance you're going to miss anything.
Okay, so that's basically the loop of monuments to the west side of the mall. Everything you just described there, except for the Jefferson, is all to the west side of the Washington Monument. Okay.
Yes, that's right.
ButcherBox is sponsoring this episode of Amateur Traveler, and I just got my first ButcherBox. I've got packed with dry ice came 4 packets of ground beef, 3 packets of chicken breasts, 2 steaks, some pork ribs, and some sirloin tips. Now, I've got a great recipe for what to do with the chicken. At least one of those packets of chicken is going to become Greek chicken and rice. And if you go to chris2x.com, I've got a recipe there that's an Instant Pot recipe. But I'm not good with steak, and so I'm going to take advantage of the fact that ButcherBox has recipes on their site at butcherbox.com to learn some great recipes to do with those steaks. You can have ButcherBox deliver meat to your doorstep. Free shipping as always, curated to custom box plans. You can easily find high-quality meat and seafood you can trust. 100% grass beef, free-range organic chicken, pork-raised crate-free, and wild-caught seafood. Humanely raised, no antibiotics or added hormones. Also like the fact that I could recycle all the box and shipping material that they sent. Sign up at butcherbox.com/traveler and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional 20% off. Choose salmon, chicken, breast, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/traveler. If you got recipes for ribs or steaks, send them my way as I send my thanks to butcherbox.com for sponsoring this episode of Amateur Traveler.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Cool. So we've done our monuments tour. Anything specific that you would want people not to miss when they do those, if they're going on their own? For instance, I'd have to say of those, the one that I am least interested in or impressed by, and this is somebody who is a real big history buff, is the World War II Memorial versus the Veterans Memorial, the Vietnam, which of course, when it opened, was unique and somber and very different kind of memorial. And leading into how Americans felt about that war, especially when it opened.
You're right. They're very different memorials. The World War II Memorial is celebratory, and the Vietnam Memorial is sad and somber. And that's for the simple fact that the outcomes were vastly different between the two.
Right.
But that's the reason why when I give a tour, I do them back to back, is because I want people to see that contrast. And people definitely have different feelings. Some people prefer one, some people prefer the other. There's no right or wrong answer when it comes to these things. And that's why you got to do them both and do them all, really, is so that you can have the experience for yourself.
Okay. And then you mentioned one of the Smithsonians, and I don't remember what the stat is in terms of if you went to all the Smithsonian museums just in D.C. proper and spent a few seconds in front of each exhibit, how many years you would be in D.C.
Yeah, I always...
The most popular ones have typically been, well, like Air and Space for people like me who grew up in the space era. But some of the newer ones that people don't know about as much, I'm hearing amazing things about. Do you have a favorite now? And
well,
do guests have a favorite?
I do have a favorite, although I try to be diplomatic when I tell people about which ones they should go to, because my opinion is that the museums you choose should be the ones that you want to go to, not the ones that I want to go to. That said, the big three are the Air and Space Museum, American History Museum, and Natural History Museum. And because the Air and Space Museum is currently under renovation, and we can talk more about that in a moment, I believe the Natural History Museum is the most attended at the moment. So the Natural History Museum is not my personal favorite. I think it's got bones, it's got bugs, it's got gems, and they're all quite interesting and quite fascinating, but it's not really my cup of tea. I'm more of a history guy myself.
Very traditional museum, too, in terms of display. Yeah.
Yeah, and like I said, the question I always ask, what can I do here that I can't do anywhere else in the world? Well, there's many amazing natural history museums all over the world, and so this one's a little less unique. Now, what you don't have everywhere in the world is American history museums, and specifically the African American History and Culture Museum, which is
I hear amazing things about.
Yes, it is amazing, and it's one of the few that has required a timed ticket since it opened and still does in 2023. So it's one you have to plan ahead for. And so when people ask me, like on my tour, for example, about it, I ask, do you have a ticket already? And if they don't, you can get a same-day ticket, so don't feel like you have to plan super far in advance. But it's better if you plan in advance and get a ticket in advance, or plan to wake up in the morning and get that same-day ticket so that you can go.
Now, it is one of the newer museums. That one is new. The Native American Museum is relatively new within the last decade. And I can't think of what the other newest museum would be in the Smithsonian catalog.
I don't think the last decade. Hold on, let me double check on that.
Am I just getting old?
No, time's a thief. That's the...
Time's a thief.
2004, it's nearly 20 years old.
Oh my goodness.
Yes.
How is that possible? Okay.
I suppose when we talk about newness, it's all relative. So the African American History Museum is the newest Smithsonian museum. It opened less than a decade ago. The American Indian Museum opened nearly 20 years ago. So it is relatively new in the scheme of history, but it's getting up there. It's almost old enough to drink.
And are there other ones that people miss because they're at the, for instance, the big three, who when you take people there or when you recommend people there, they just love?
Yes, two in particular. The first is the National Postal Museum, which is next to Union Station. Now, part of the reason why this one is often skipped is because it's not in the museum core. Many of these museums are
on the mall.
Mm-hmm. On the mall, in between, specifically in between the Capitol and the Washington Monument. And the Postal Museum is not far away. I don't want to make it sound like it's out of town. Mm-hmm. It's barely a mile away, but it's over by Union Station, and it is great. It's in some ways like an alternative American History Museum. You're learning about American history through the perspective of the Postal Service. If you're a stamp collector, also has amazing stamp collections. I'm not personally a stamp collector, but I do occasionally like to go peruse and see what stamps are on display. So whether you're a history person or a stamp collector, the Postal Museum is one of them. And the other one is the National Portrait Gallery. That's also off of the museum core. So it's on 7th Street. It's just a little bit uptown near the Capital One Arena, and it's a museum of portraits and another amazing way to learn history through sort of an alternative lens. So it's not like American history in your face, but look at the portraits of these people who did these things, and then you can learn about them in that way. So pretty cool. And those are the two I think that people are often impressed with when I tell them, hey, have you considered these? And they go and they check them out and they like them.
Now, stop me if I'm wrong, but everything you have mentioned so far, except if you do a tour of the monuments, is free.
That's right. So one thing that I think is great about Washington, D.C. is that in 2023, demand for travel is as high as it's been. Inflation, everybody's been reading about inflation. Things are getting more expensive. And the free things in Washington, D.C. are still free. So as travel gets more expensive across the board, broadly, Washington, D.C. gets relatively even more affordable, even better value. And so I think the cool thing about that is that you can come to Washington, D.C., and you could fill up an entire week's itinerary, potentially, with free or mostly free things to do and spend relatively little money. Or you could splurge and fill it up with lots of luxurious things to do and spend lots of money. And I think that's different from a destination like a Disney theme park or a Las Vegas, which if you're going there in 2023, you're pretty much resigned to, I'm going to spend a small fortune in this place for as long as I'm there. And I think Washington, D.C., you can more choose your own adventure in a way.
Now, if we said, okay, I've spent some time in museums here, and if I wanted to extend that to some of the non-free museums, do you have your favorites or your guests' favorites in the next 3 to 5 non-free museums, non-public
museums? We actually don't have that many non-free museums, Chris, to be honest. And it's for the simple reason that it's a tough business model. It's a tough business model to run a for-profit paid museum when you've got lots of amazing free museums. And I think the example of this is the Newseum. Since
Yes,
you've been to D.C. before. You hopefully went before it closed.
I did go before it closed, yeah.
Some people think it's a COVID casualty. It's actually not. It closed at the end of 2019. So like December 31st, 2019 was its last day. And it closed for the simple reason that the business model just didn't make sense. They just couldn't turn a profit selling tickets to a paid museum when there's so many amazing free museums nearby. So there's actually not that many paid museums. But the one that I like and that most people like is the International Spy Museum.
Sure.
They just moved into a brand new building in Lafont Plaza. So they used to have a museum north of the National Mall, and it was relatively limited in space. Their square footage wasn't that great. And they moved to this new, much larger building south of the National Mall at Lafont Plaza. And so they have a lot more space now. They have amazing artifacts, and it's much more interactive than a lot of the Smithsonian museums are. So while the Smithsonian museums are great for many reasons, they are very traditional museums, right? You're going in, you're looking at artifacts, you're reading little information cards, and that's great. But especially for kids, it can get boring eventually, right? Like kids only have attention spans that last so far. And so the International Spy Museum is great because when you go, you are assigned a spy persona, you're given a mission, you're given instructions to complete your mission. So whenever I have kids who come on my tour who told me they had previously gone to the International Spy Museum, my first question always is, did you complete your mission? And most of the time they did. The only time they didn't is if they went too late in the day and they ran out of time. So if you have kids, try to go earlier in the day so they have enough time to complete their mission. But that's the number one paid museum that people go to and that they really like. And I like to.
Excellent. What else are you going to recommend for people to do in DC?
So once you've exhausted your federal government sites, I think you want to start thinking about doing some non-governmental stuff. And one thing that I personally like to do, and that I think unfortunately doesn't get done nearly enough, is exploring neighborhoods. Washington, D.C. has over 100 neighborhoods, distinct neighborhoods, and I think people who visit from out of town spend far too much time on the National Mall and far too little time in the neighborhoods. And now, I'm not saying you need to spend none of your time on the National Mall and all of your time in these neighborhoods, but I'm saying instead of 90%, 10%, maybe 70-30, maybe 60-40. And because people ask me all the time about, what do people who live here do? What's it like to actually live here and not just be a tourist? And you're never really going to get an answer to that question if you just spend all of your time in the area around the museums. So going into some of the neighborhoods and checking those out. And of course, you're not going to go to 100 over 100 different neighborhoods either. So choosing some that might interest you. Georgetown is not the only neighborhood in DC, even though it is the most popular neighborhood for out-of-towners, for tourists. And go to Georgetown. It's great. It's historic. It's got cobblestone streets and historic buildings and lots of shopping. But a few of my favorites are Capitol Hill, which is on the east side of the Capitol building, the southwest area. So if you go southwest of the Washington Monument, the area around there, and DuPont Circle. I think it's close to downtown, but it's far enough away that it feels more neighborhoody and less downtowny than some of the areas around the monuments and museums.
Just picking one of those, let's do the four of those. So I'm in Georgetown, which you mentioned. What am I doing in Georgetown?
Georgetown is an interesting one because it's a neighborhood that's got a ton of history. It's one of the few areas in D.C. that has existed for longer than Washington, D.C. has existed, meaning that it existed in the colonial era, right? So, for example, the oldest building in Washington, D.C., the old stone house, is on M Street in Georgetown. And it's got Julia Child's former home from when she lived in D.C. It's got the Exorcist stairs. It's got a waterfront park. So this is actually a neighborhood where I do recommend taking a neighborhood tour. And I do not lead a Georgetown neighborhood tour myself. It's a neighborhood I don't know nearly well enough to feel confident in doing that. But I do know there are some really good ones. For example, DC Design Tours has a really good Georgetown neighborhood tour. But it's worth doing because you're going to discover things on a tour that if you're just wandering around are way too easy to miss. And you might walk past a building and there might be a plaque on it. And unless you stop and read that plaque, you're not going to know what that building is or why it's important. So I definitely recommend that as an overview of the neighborhood. If you are a movie buff, obviously go to the Exorcist Stairs. It's great, historic, fun place to go. Go to the Waterfront Park, get some takeout food from one of the restaurants on M Street, and then go down to the Waterfront Park and make yourself a picnic. And I just did an interview for my own podcast with the food editor for Washingtonian Magazine, and I asked her about an article she wrote where she said, Georgetown is becoming a hip neighborhood restaurant again. It wasn't for a long time, and because of COVID, the real estate market has changed, and now it's becoming a hip restaurant area again. So definitely find some good food while you're there.
Do you have a particular restaurant or two that you would recommend we check out?
One of my favorite cafes in D.C. is called Yellow the Cafe, and they used to have a cafe at their sister restaurant called Albee. And my understanding is that it was always supposed to be a temporary cafe, and it recently closed. But they opened up a new one over in Georgetown, so I have not been to the Georgetown location, but I have been to Yellow the Cafe, and it is extremely good. So I highly recommend going to their spot in Georgetown when that opens. And then, in fact, one of my favorite quote-unquote cheap eats is over in Georgetown as well. It's called Falafel Inc. So it's falafel pitas, falafel salads, and one of the few places where you can get in and out for, nowadays in 2023, under $10. A cheap eat used to be $5 and under. Now it's more like $10 and under. But yeah, that's really good too. And I typically go to one of their other locations because it's a little far away from me, the Georgetown one. But if you're in Georgetown, yeah, stop over there because it's good.
And the one thing we should say is one of the nice things about being an international city, in the sense that there are so many people represented from so many places, just embassies alone, that there is a good variety of food in D.C.
Yeah, I agree with that. Although I think the embassies have less a role to play in that than people might think. The two biggest international cuisines in D.C. are Ethiopian and Salvadorian, and that's just by virtue of the fact that many people who left Ethiopia during their civil war settled in the DC area, and a lot of people from El Salvador who have immigrated wound up either in Washington, D.C. or Los Angeles. So those two places have a lot of Salvadorian food, where much of the country has other types of food. In Miami, there's Cuban food. Sure. In Houston, there's Mexican food. And in D.C., there's Salvadorian food.
Although if you're looking for Mexican food in D.C., I would recommend Taco Bamba, but that's all over that D.C. area as a place that I always make sure that I eat. And this is somebody who's from California praising the tacos from someplace else, which is worth noting.
It is worth noting. I always have to be careful when I meet someone from Texas or California and they ask me about Mexican food in D.C. And I always say, you know what, probably just stick to what you like back home and try something new while you're here, because you're more likely to be disappointed than you are to be satisfied.
Cool. You talked about what to do in Georgetown and then DuPont Circle.
Yeah, DuPont Circle. I would probably stop at Kramer's. It used to be called Kramer Books. Now it's called Kramer's. It's still a bookstore. And I think one of the old pastimes when you travel now is to go into a bookstore, because they're becoming a bit of a rare breed. And so Kramer's is unique because it's not just a bookstore, but it's also a restaurant and a coffee shop. And so there's different things to check out while you're in there. And DuPont Circle has a good mix of places to eat, and you can stroll around and look at the historic houses. It's got the classic DC row houses. It's also the area where you'll find a lot of embassies. Some people really like just wandering around and spotting the different flags from the different countries and looking at the buildings from the outside. And that's all over in DuPont Circle. You'll find many embassies in that part of town, although in reality, embassies are scattered all over DC, not just in one specific area.
Okay. And then you mentioned Southwest.
Yeah, so Southwest is another neighborhood that people nowadays are going to because of the development called The Wharf. And The Wharf is fairly new. It's a big multi-billion dollar development. Many locals don't like it, and I disagree with them, but you might, if you ask locals, they might say, oh, don't go there. It's not authentic, or they might say it's too corporate, or whatever they say. I disagree, but that's okay. The great thing about DC is that we don't just have one type of neighborhood. We have many types, and so you can go and try them all for yourself and decide what you like. But beyond The Wharf, which is a new development, there's a neighborhood that goes back decades, and there are just regular folks who live in town who live there, and there's Audi Field, which is the somewhat new soccer stadium, is over in Southwest as well. So if you're going to a soccer game, you may find yourself over there. So typically you'll probably go over there either for The Wharf or for a soccer game, but definitely take a stroll around the neighborhood. There's a little duck pond that is quite fun to stop in. Look at the ducks, take some photos of the ducks while you're over there.
One of the things that surprises me about a lot of cities in the U.S., and D.C. would be in them, is how much they ignored their waterfront for so many years. And there were monuments and things like that and parks along the waterfront, but there weren't as many interesting waterfront neighborhoods in D.C. for years. And now there's National Harbor a little further away and The Wharf and a couple more attempts to say, hey, we've got this beautiful river here and why don't we do something with this real estate?
Yeah, at Georgetown as well. The Georgetown waterfront for many years was where they stored salt for salting the streets in the winter. And you look at it now and it's this amazing, beautiful, lush green park with people picnicking and picking up their food and bringing it down there. And you think, man, what a waste for all those years that it was just storage. So I agree with you.
And then you name one more neighborhood and I'm drawing a blank.
Capitol Hill, right?
Capitol Hill. There we go.
So Capitol Hill's great. I think if money was no object and I could live anywhere in D.C., I would probably have a great historic four-bedroom row house in Capitol Hill. Unfortunately, money is an object and you have to pick and choose. And so it's a great neighborhood. It has very neighborly vibes. You go there and you just feel like the people who live over here like living over here. It's close to the Capitol, so it's relatively close to some of the big tourist sites. It is not political in the way you might think. You might think, oh, that's where all the Congress members live. And you know, some of them may live over in Capitol Hill, but many of them don't. So don't think of it as just a political place. It's definitely, when you go there, you'll find a very neighborhood-like place. Lincoln Park is named after Abraham Lincoln. It's the centerpiece of the neighborhood. And you go there on a weekend and you're just going to understand what I mean when I say that this is a neighborly area. And Eastern Market, which is one of the few remaining public markets left in the country. There's not really too many of these left, and you can go in there during the week, and it's got all your standard marketplaces like your butcher, your grocer, your cheesemonger, your florist, and then you go there on the weekend, and they have the farmer's market, and they have the flea market, and it's just a fun time. And if you want to get some souvenirs that are a little bit more unique than the stuff you get at the standard tourist gift stores, then the flea market is a pretty cool place to do that.
Okay. We've still stayed fairly close. We didn't get very far from the Washington Monument here at this point. If I had to draw a circle around every place you've talked about, if I'm going to go a little further afield, where should I go?
So the reason we haven't drawn the circle very far is because I don't think you should go far just for the sake of it. I think there's so much to do in town. That said, probably the next spot would be the National Zoo, which is about four miles away uptown. You can get there on the metro fairly easily. And a lot of people like going to the National Zoo because it is one of only three zoos left in the United States that still has giant pandas. The other two are Atlanta and Memphis, which means that the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. is also the only one of those three that is free. So you can go up there, see the pandas, see everything else. I will say, though, that there are some amazing zoos in the United States, and some of them are big. You can go to zoos in Columbus. You can go to zoos in Omaha, in New York City, and they're huge. And our zoo is, even though it's called the National Zoo, is more like a neighborhood zoo. It has more of a neighborhood feel. Not as big, not as spaced out, not as many animals, but definitely a fun time, and especially if you want to see those giant pandas.
All right. Where to next?
Now, if you want to go to Virginia, most people are going to go over there to Arlington National Cemetery, and that is one that I think is worth going to at least once and seeing. The big three sites are, of course, the Arlington House, the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, and the Changing of the Guard there, and JFK's burial site with the eternal flame. But you can also see more. There's lots more to see there, and either you can DIY a little tour, or they do have a few guided tour options, although I think there might only be one company that does a tour on transportation. Otherwise, it's going to be like a walking tour. But that's typically what people go to the Virginia side for. Or they'll go over to the Virginia side because they want to go to Old Town Alexandria. And that is a fantastic old town. Although I think once you get to that far away, you're getting into day trip territory. Even though it's not way far out of town, it's far enough where it feels like you're going to go down there for the day, come back into town at the end of the day, and it's kind of like a day trip.
Easy to get there in the metro, though.
It is on the metro. The yellow line was under construction for the end of 2022 and the first several months of 2023, but it's back open, so it's a easy ride down to Old Town Alexandria on the metro, on the yellow line. You can also take the water taxi from the wharf to Old Town Alexandria.
Oh, okay.
I am a little frustrated, a little disappointed. The price of the water taxi is now owned by a big tourism conglomerate that owns boats and water tour companies all over the world, and the prices are really high, in my opinion. So it's the kind of thing where, I don't know, kind of like the cable car in San Francisco. It's technically transportation, but it's priced in such a way that it's more like a ride, like an amusement park ride. And so it's okay, if you're a family of four, you're now looking at over $100 round trip to get four people to and from Old Town Alexandria on the boat. And maybe that's worth it. I'm not saying that it's not worth it. It's definitely more scenic than the metro. It's definitely more unique than the metro. But it's good that we have options, that we have more than just that to get down there.
Okay. What else should I make sure I see when I'm in the D.C. area?
So I think, like I was saying, if you're building your itinerary so that it's a mix of government stuff and non-government stuff, I think you might want to start thinking about, do I want to see a show? I think Washington, D.C. is not Broadway, but the theater scene is punching above its weight. I think it's quite good. You have the Kennedy Center, which is pretty well-known, pretty famous. You have the National Theater, and they have their Broadway series, so you can see Broadway-caliber plays in D.C. We have some of the best live music in the country. There are several live music venues. There's the 930 Club, which is pretty famous. The Foo Fighters play there frequently. Dave Grohl talks about how it's one of his favorite venues in all of the world. And the same company owns the Anthem, which is at the Wharf. There's two other smaller venues at the Wharf. They just opened up next door to the 930 Club, a replica of the original 930. It's getting confusing because the 930 Club that exists now is different from the one that existed way back in the day. But there's a lot of opportunities if you want to see a show, whether it's musical or a rock concert or symphony or opera or whatever. You can do that here. And also pro sports. I am a big fan of pro sports. I'm trying to get into soccer. I didn't really grow up watching soccer. I grew up as a baseball, basketball, football type fan. And so we now have the DC United and Washington Spirit are both playing at Audi Field, which, like I mentioned earlier, is in the Southwest neighborhood. So if you've never been to a soccer game, go to a soccer game because they're fun. And I didn't really appreciate that until I got a chance to go to some myself. But every single pro sports league has a team in DC. I think that's one of the greatest things about living here, actually, is that there are so many options when it comes to stuff like that. So yeah, find some stuff that's not the federal government stuff, but that you like and that you'll enjoy and that you can say, you know what, I saved up, I'm taking this trip, I want to splurge a little bit. Even if I could theoretically do this back home, I'm going to make it part of my trip and make it part of my memories.
You mentioned that a lot of the museums, a lot of the government sites are going to close at 5 o'clock. For a family that's bringing their kids, they're doing that, hey, Discover Your History tour, what are you going to recommend for them for the evening that you haven't already mentioned?
Yeah, this is one of the trickiest things about DC is that we are not as good as other destinations for evening activities. Mm-hmm. And I'm a little jealous because I was just asking a friend of mine who's a tour guide in New York City. I was like, what do you do with kids after New York after hours? And they were, no, like the Empire State Building is open till midnight. The Top of the Rock is open late. There's lots of things that you can do that are kid-friendly, family-friendly, that are open all the way up until really late at night. And we just don't have things like that here. We don't have tall buildings in DC, so we don't have those type of observatories. But that's why a lot of people do their monuments tour in the evening. And you'll often hear this piece of advice to, quote-unquote, see the monuments at night. And I think that's, I think it's good and well-intentioned advice. I think it's a little trickier than that, especially if you're visiting in the summer when it doesn't get dark until 9 o'clock. Right. Seeing them, quote-unquote, at night means staying up pretty late. But I do think seeing them in the evening is a good strategy because it gives you something to do after the museums close at 5. And there are a few museums that are open late. So the National Portrait Gallery that I mentioned earlier, they stay open till 7. The Spy Museum, depends on the season. During peak season, they sometimes stay open till almost 8 o'clock. So there are some evening options. And if you are lucky enough to be here at a time when there's a basketball game happening, a Washington Wizards game, those are in the evenings. Those are family friendly. Same with the Washington Nationals. Those are great for families, great for kids. So there's a few options. It's not once it hits the clock strikes 5, there's nothing to do. But I do agree it is challenging and you want to think about that as you're building your itinerary. The one tricky thing is if you have kids, especially, kids typically can't stay out that late just because they're exhausted. They go hard when they come to Washington, D.C. They're up early. They're walking 5, 6, 7 miles a day, right? And kids can only go until they run out of gas. And so that's why I, when I do an evening tour of the monuments, started at 5 o'clock, 5:30 at the latest, is because I know most kids, by the time the clock hits 8 o'clock, they're done. They're ready to call it.
Because sometimes with kids, it's just easy to get a hotel with a pool, and you don't have to worry about how to entertain the kids at night or something like that.
Yeah, and if you're going to look for a hotel with a pool, that's tricky. Not a lot of downtown hotels in D.C. have pools. So you might wind up in the suburbs if a pool is going to be something you're looking for. And be careful as well, because a lot of hotels, if you are only perusing the list of amenities, it might say it has a pool, but be careful it's not like a rooftop pool that's really actually like a swim-up bar or something like that, meant for adults and not meant for families with kids. I think if you pick a hotel in the suburbs, it's more likely to have an indoor pool or a kid-friendly pool than one in the city.
Now, there are many places we didn't talk about it, and some just, I'm sure, for lack of time. There's only so much you can do. There's only so much you can talk about on a podcast also, but are there places you specifically skipped?
I think you asked about this earlier, and I never really talked about it, but it's the White House tour. And I think it's worth talking about because it's one of those things where people have very different expectations for what they're going to get on a White House tour. And I just want to say off the bat, the public tour of the White House is not a tour of the West Wing. That is a completely separate thing. If you want to tour the West Wing, you got to know somebody who works at the White House who has privileges to get you in the West Wing. And I've been fortunate enough that I've been able to do it, but many people will not be fortunate enough and will not be able to do it. So the public tour of the White House takes you through the blue room, the green room, the red room, the state dining room, the China room, the Vermeil room. And if you're not recognizing the names of any of these rooms, then you might go and you might be disappointed because you think, where's the Oval Office? Where's the Situation Room? They're not included on that tour. But the mistake that people make when it comes to the White House is, to get a tour of the White House in 2023, you have to contact your member of Congress's office. And we've talked about that, how to do that before when we were talking about the Capitol. And on many of the forums, it will say, tell us 3 days when you are available to go to the White House. And so you look at your week and you say, oh, and of course, it's not available every day of the week. So you say, okay, I suppose I'm available on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And they'll submit all three of those for the White House. And then they are building the rest of their itinerary. And they're like, oh, I have to hold all three of these days now. I can't schedule anything on these days because what if I get the tour? I don't want to miss the White House tour because I already booked something else. But the White House only tells you about a week in advance whether you got one or not, and many people won't get one. So what I recommend people do, and some people might not like to hear this, is when they ask you, what days are you available? Just choose one day. Just say, I'm available on Wednesday. And that way you're only holding one day off of your calendar. And if you get it, great. And if you don't get it, then okay, at least I only held one day back and didn't miss out on other things. Because something that happened just recently, just this spring break. So my tours were completely sold out this spring break. Spring break in Washington, D.C. this year was bonkers. 2023, everybody was out traveling again. And I got a message from someone way too late. And they said, can we book a tour? Unfortunately, we were waiting to hear back from the White House. And we didn't book anything on any of these days. And once they heard back, they went to go book stuff and everything was sold out. Not just my tours, but many things during spring break this year just got booked up and sold out. And so they wound up missing out on a lot of stuff because they were holding all of those days for their White House tour. And in the end, did get one. They did get a reservation, but then the other 2 days were just written off and hard to fill up.
Anything else we want to talk about and recommend for people to see while they're in D.C. before we get to some of our wrap-up questions?
I think one thing we haven't really talked about is day trips or side trips, and I think people should be careful with these. So there are a lot of things nearby D.C. So I already mentioned Old Town Alexandria as a day trip, and I think this is a good one for someone who is here for a week and who's thinking, I just want to have a day when I'm not in D.C., when I'm quote-unquote out of the city, and I think Old Town Alexandria is a good one for that. But you could go to Gettysburg, you could go to Monticello, you could go to Baltimore, you could go to Annapolis. There's lots of places that you start looking at the map and you're like, oh, this is not too far. Even Philadelphia is only a 90-minute train ride. I do not recommend a day trip to Philadelphia because it's not enough time to go there. But I think you should think about day trips as having a purpose, meaning I want to go to Gettysburg because I'm a huge Civil War history buff and I've never been there before and I want to see where history happened. Or I want to go to Monticello because I am learning all about Thomas Jefferson. I got super interested from watching the show Hamilton, and now I want to see where he lived, right? Or I want to go to Baltimore because I want to see a big city I've never been to before. I think where people get tripped up is they are here for 7 days, and 4 of those days they're out of town. They're going to all these other places, not because they necessarily have a reason to go to them, but just because they're like, oh, since I'm in the area, I should go check these places out. I don't think that's a good way to approach it. I think you should have a purpose for going to places that you go to.
All right. As we start to wrap this up, you're standing in the prettiest spot in Washington, D.C. Where are you standing and what are you looking at?
Oh, this is an easy one. This is the top step of the Lincoln Memorial, looking out at the postcard view of the National Mall. You get the Washington Monument reflected in the reflecting pool. You can see, if you're off on the side, you can see the Capitol Dome off in the distance. And this is a spot where everyone has to stand if you're going to come to Washington, D.C. Go stand on that top step, take in the view, get a photo, and just enjoy it.
You were mentioning there are no tall buildings in Washington. I guess we didn't say that was, as I recall, intentional, that there are regulations in terms of how tall they can be, and they can't be taller than, is it the Capitol or the Washington Monument?
It's neither. That's actually one of the worst myths in Washington, D.C., is that buildings can't be taller than the Washington Monument. The Washington Monument's 555 feet tall, and I think there'd be some developers who would be thrilled to build 50-story tall skyscrapers in downtown D.C. It's actually a law that was passed back in the 1800s, in the 1890s, the Height of Buildings Act, and it's thanks to a building over near the DuPont Circle area called the Cairo, which opened as a hotel, and now it's a condo and apartment building. But it was a skyscraper, 14 stories tall back in the 1800s was a skyscraper. And the neighbors hated it. The neighbors absolutely hated it. So they marched down to Congress and demanded that no more tall buildings be permitted in Washington, D.C. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending whether you like or dislike the rule, it's an act of Congress that would require an act of Congress to repeal. And so the rule has been changed and altered over the years. But basically, buildings in Washington, D.C. cannot be taller than the width of the street that they're on plus about 20 feet, with many exceptions. There's lots of streets that have exceptions to that rule. But that's the reason why there's no building that's even close to as tall as the Washington Monument. And the tallest buildings in the city are typically on Pennsylvania Avenue between the Capitol and the White House, because that's one of the few spots that has an exception to the stricter rule.
This is actually one of the reasons I love having on local guests who know more than me, because I love learning stuff like this, and I don't mind learning when I'm wrong.
Yeah, it's good. I'm happy to spread the word, because, like I said, it's one of the worst myths, and it's often perpetuated by people like Uber drivers who will pick someone up from the airport, and they'll someone will ask, hey, how come there's no tall buildings here? And they'll just repeat the myth, and then it just never ends.
Interesting. So now you have to tell me if the other myth that I've heard is true. So we know that you mentioned Lafont Plaza before, and Pierre Lafont being the French architect who was hired to design the city, who apparently, I was told in my history book, left in a huff. And the only reason we know his designs, or what were reported to be his designs, was that there was a free black man named Benjamin Banneker who memorized his designs, and this layout of the city we have, I was told in my history book, was what Benjamin Banneker told us Pierre Lafont designed.
Yeah, I think there's, now I can't confirm or deny exactly every detail of that story, but on one of my own podcast episodes, I interviewed Carolyn, who's the owner of DC Design Tours, and she would be much better to speak on this specific question, being an architect herself. But I think when you said left in a huff, I believe she would say that Lafont was fired. So this is one of those debates over, you can't fire me because I quit sort of situations. But yeah, Lafont gets a lot more credit than he probably deserves, and other people get a lot less credit than they probably deserve. But this is one that's a little bit outside my wheelhouse, so I don't want to make any statements that are incorrect.
Yeah, I just always wondered, are we really seeing the city that Lafont designed, or are we seeing the city that Banneker designed? I do not know.
Well,
I don't think anyone will.
Like many things in life, it's probably both. There's probably some of both, and that's why I say Lafont probably gets more credit than he deserves, although we could certainly debate all day about whether that's true too.
Who knows? Excellent. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in DC.
Oh boy. So the thing that always comes to mind is people going to bars and watching news events like they're sports. And this is something that I do not participate in. I do not think this is something that's worth doing. But for example, on election day, election night, when you watch TV and the anchors are talking about this person won this state, this person won this state, people in D.C. will go to bars and treat that like it's a sporting event. And I do not partake in that. But when I think of only in D.C., that is one thing that comes to mind.
That's funny. And if you had to summarize Washington, D.C. in just three words, what three words would you use?
Oh, man, this is a tough one. I would say unique, friendly, and fun.
Excellent. Excellent. Our guest again is Rob from TripHacksDC.com. Rob, if we wanted to send people to your best post or podcast on DC, where would we send them?
Great question. I am in the process of recording an episode that is tentatively titled something like My Overarching Philosophy About Washington, D.C. Travel. And it's not going to be ready by the time that this is live, but that's going to be the one that I would send people to. I also have a YouTube video. It's about 20 minutes long, and it's called the comprehensive guide, or no, the ultimate guide to visiting Washington, D.C. And I think that's a great place to start. If you have never seen or heard me before this episode, that's probably where I would send you. But in the meantime, I have produced quite a few episodes of the podcast this year that I'm quite proud of. And I'm going to have a new episode coming up on food and restaurants. I know we barely scratched the surface of that topic today. Right, so sure. Maybe that's a good opportunity to leave this episode and go over to that and check out my thoughts about food and restaurants in DC.
Excellent. Rob, thanks so much for coming on Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your obvious love for Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Chris. I appreciate it.
I had, in fact, planned for this week's episode to be about Greece. We're going to do that next week. I'm starting to get my full voice back. I'm still got this cough that came back with me from Greece, but we'll get there eventually. Special thanks to the patrons of the show who help support Amateur Traveler financially. If you're interested in becoming a patron of the show or just learning more about it, you can go to patreon.com/amateurtraveler. And thanks for the patrons who hung out with me last Saturday morning as we did our monthly Zoom call. I want to repeat the announcement that I did last week just to make sure that people hear about it. Unfortunately, the Japan trip for the Amateur Traveler for 2023 is canceled. I did not get enough people to sign up for that. So the next trip will be the trip to Morocco in 2024, which the first trip has sold out, and we're starting to put people on a second trip. And I'll give you more updates as I learn more about that. And with that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. And thanks so much for listening.